There's more left? Did anybody not get them that needs them? you need them. Yeah, you need them. There's certain things it's okay to need.
Chocolate
and Thin Mint Girl Scout cookies.
They were very fresh.
So. We just found them and I had to get them. Okay. So thank you for coming back. Hi, Karen. So good to see you. How's your family?
Why, thank you.
Okay. Octavia must be very, very big now. Ooh. When I see these kids grow up, the girls at the Vajrapani family camp that grew up there, the daughters of like longtime Dharma practitioners, these girls that are now friends of mine, you know, they're in their 30s and they're wonderful. So they grew up at the camp and then I came in to be the director and they were still little girls, you know, and then we watched them kind of 8 years old, 11 years old, 12, and then there's that, suddenly there's like a week, 1 week it happened, and then I saw them, and they were little girls, and their, you know, their clothes and their faces, and then in 1 week something changed, and then it started with like, you know, sculpting their eyebrows and something, that was it, in the childhood, that it was over, and they never looked like that again, you know, there's that thing, and then it's gone, and then it's so fleeting, so when you have young kids, it's, you know, when you're in it, you feel like it'll never end. Well, you know, and then it really goes by pretty quickly. So let's come back to a little bit of meditation. Actually, what I'd like to do for you to reflect, I'm going to read something I want you to reflect through. Just reflect. This is a little bit more traditional kind of prayer, but something to kind of put your mind, remind your mind about what could be helpful. Essence encompassing all the Buddhas, originator of the holy Dharma of scripture and realization, principles of all the Aryas intending virtue, in the glorious holy Gurus, I take refuge. Please, Gurus, bless my mind to become Dharma, Dharma to become the path, and the path to be without obstacles. Until I achieve Buddhahood, please bless me to be like youthful Norzang and Bodhisattva always crying, incorrectly following the virtuous friend with pure thought and action, seeing whatever is done as pure, and accomplishing whatever is said and advised. Please bless me to see this greatly meaningful body with freedoms and richnesses is difficult to find and easily perishes, that action and result are so profound, and that the sufferings of the evil-gone transmigratory beings are so difficult to bear. Therefore, please bless me to take refuge from the depths of my heart in the three rare sublime ones, to abandon negative karma, and to accomplish virtue according to Dharma. In dependence upon that, even if I achieve the mere higher rebirth of a deva or human, I will still have to experience suffering endlessly in samsara because of not having abandoned and being under the control of the disturbing thought obscurations. Therefore, please bless me to reflect well upon the way of circling in samsara and to continuously follow day and night the path of the three types of precious trainings, the principal method for becoming free from samsara. In dependence upon that, even if I achieve mere liberation, since there is no sentient being of the six types who has not been my father and mother, Please bless me to think I must fulfill their purpose, turn away from the lower happiness of nirvana. Then please bless me to generate precious bodhicitta by equalizing and exchanging myself with others and to follow the conduct of the conqueror's sons, the six paramitas, and so forth. Having trained my mind in the common path in that way, I will not be upset even if I have to experience the sufferings of samsara for a long time. However, please bless me to look at sentient beings with extraordinary, unbearable compassion and to enter the quick path of the Vajrayana teachings. Then please bless me to protect my vows and samaya more than my life and to quickly accomplish the unified Vajradhara state in one brief lifetime of this degenerate time. May I not give rise to heresy for even a second in regard to the actions of the glorious Guru. May I see whatever actions are done as pure. With this devotion, may I receive the Guru's blessings in my heart. Magnificent and precious Root Guru, please abide on the lotus seat at my heart. Guide me with your great kindness and grant me the realizations of your holy body, speech, and mind. And as if your teacher, any particular teacher, is over your crown of your head, facing the same direction as you, imagine them dissolving into a radiant light and dissolving into your heart. Just feel all those blessings. And just reflect on these other verses. This is a way of how to live your life for sentient beings. Determined to obtain the greatest possible benefit from all sentient beings who are more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel, I shall hold them most dear at all times. May I become like a wish-granting jewel, fulfilling all the wishes and like a wish-granting tree, fulfilling all the hopes of transmigratory beings. For the sake of accomplishing the two purposes of all sentient beings, without any sense of loss or concern, I give away my body and likewise my enjoyments, such as food and clothing, and even all my virtues accumulated over the three times. By abandoning attachment and giving everything away, I will pass beyond sorrow. My mind will achieve the non-abiding, sorrowless state, the state of omniscience. Since I will have to give up everything all at once when I die, it's best for me to give it away to sentient beings, because Buddhahood is attained in that way. As I've already given this body an impure aggregate to all beings to use for their pleasure, even if they always kill me, criticize me, beat me, or so forth, I will let them do whatever they like. From now on, whether they play games with my body or make it an object of laughter by ridiculing and making fun of it to hurt me, since I've already given this body of mine to sentient beings, why would I resist by protecting it and so forth? I will also use it to do any virtuous action that doesn't harm and benefits others. Whenever any sentient being encounters me, may it never be meaningless for them and always be meaningful. Whenever someone has an angry or devotional thought arise just by looking at me, may that attitude alone become a cause that always accomplishes all the temporary and ultimate purposes of that being. Whenever others criticize me with their speech, harm me with their bodies, or likewise insult me behind my back, may all of them have the fortune to achieve great enlightenment. May I be a savior for those who lack a savior, a guide for all the beings who enter a road, a boat, a ship, and a bridge for those who want to cross the water. May I be an island for those who seek the safe shore of an island, a light for those who want a light, bedding for those who wish for bedding, and for all beings who desire a servant, may I become a servant of them all. May I be a wish-granting jewel and a wish-fulfilling vase, giving rise to whatever is desired, such as food and clothing, powerful mantra accomplishing the actions of pacification, increase, and so forth, great medicine curing every sickness, a wish-fulfilling tree satisfying every need, and a wish-granting cow for all beings. Like the four great elements, the earth and so forth, and like the sky, may I always be a means of living in every way for the innumerable sentient beings. Likewise, may I be a means of living at all times and in all ways for the realms of sentient beings equaling the extent of space until they all attain the sorrowless state. As long as space remains, as long as transmigratory beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the suffering of transmigratory beings. And just think, today I'm going to use my body, speech, and mind in virtue for sentient beings. And I'd like you to reflect now on the situation you looked at yesterday morning, where you were blocked from experiencing joy. A situation that was not joyful. So if you were not here yesterday, bring up in your mind, if possible, something recent. When you did not experience joy, we were looking yesterday at what were the obstacles in the path of joy in that situation. Can you have a look at your mindset in the situation? Did you have any expectations? Were they realistic? Did I lack perspective, perhaps, of the situation, of the larger issue, placing it in a larger context? How was humility involved in it, or humor? Were they in the situation working or not? What about acceptance? Was I placing some undue burden on myself or others that was unreasonable? Not accepting limitations and boundaries? And just have a look around in the situation. Are you alone? Are you with others? Inside? Are you outside? And what does it look like of what might be an obstacle in this situation? And with the four pillars of joy we discussed yesterday, perspective, humility, humor, acceptance, with some rooting in ideas like that you have a precious human rebirth that is quickly passing away. What will protect you from more suffering? And how would you like to conduct yourself? Are you living a relatively ethical life? That's your support for the pillars of joy. And the pillars of joy help create this container for that Lamrim practice. So, looking at this non-joyful situation, using the variety of tools, go into the situation. Can you make some slight adjustments right now that move it into a more joyful experience? Please practice. So we can role play more analytically in meditation a situation that didn't go well. We go back in there in meditation. And again, that second fundamental practice, do something different. So you practice it in your mind, and you practice it again and again and again. You do it again. And then one day, in your regular life, it automatically appears, that behavior. More accessible. So slowly just finish up and look at those, an adjustment you might have made. Can you inhale and breathe in some space in this non-joyful situation and observe anything changing? If you'd like, make a determination in your mind right now that the next time you notice this habit or trigger that holds you hostage in non-joy, can you implement and introduce this adjustment? Be determined about it. You can do this. Please relax and slowly open your eyes. Wait, I want to explain. Let me turn that off. Does anybody in here do that prayer in the morning? Nobody? Thank you. Thank you. So what we just did is the method. The method to transform a suffering life into happiness. This is Lama Zopa Rinpoche's instructions now for every student. It's the first thing he gives people to do. Anyone who asks for his advice. But this is also what he gave us to combat what we could do right now for the coronavirus. We just did. Part of it. Okay, then there's mantras you can recite. So, what it is the beginning, just three pages. I mean, it didn't take long, actually. I led you into a meditation after about your non-joyful thing, but 10 minutes to reflect on it, okay, takes you through the Lam Rim. And then there's some other verses. So let me explain just a little bit. I think it's important to go through this. And I really love this verse. Please, gurus, bless my mind to become Dharma, Dharma to become the path, and the path to be without obstacles. It's like your basic, it's what we want. You know, we want to clear the space. It's a very old prayer as well, those lines. Somebody, my first trip to Tibet, 1987, I just met the Dharma, and I did a 10-day course. Then I had the good fortune to go to Tibet with Rinpoche. And I had a monk friend that was with us that I met, new friend. And I remember when I was leaving Tibet earlier than Rinpoche's group, I had to go earlier and leave, and they were going on to Amdo and other things. He gave me a Chenrasig card, the Buddha of Compassion. And on the back, my friend, he wrote that, may my mind be without obstacles in the path. And so it always really stuck in me. And then it turned up here. And I was like, oh, how sweet. You know, I've been saying that for years. And but what Rinpoche goes into, and then it says, if you're not sure, you can download this online, put it on your phone, instead of playing like Angry Birds or whatever people play, okay? To be youthful, to be like youthful Norzang and Bodhisattva always crying. These are disciples of the Buddha, disciples of holy. Bodhisattva always crying. That sounds kind of dramatic, okay? So what he was is this being was so moved by his teachers that he would cry. So in a good way, good tears of the movement and the devotion he had. So what he did is one of his famous things was the teacher was coming in, you know, the dusty plateau of Tibet at the time, and it was so dusty, but he wanted to wash down the path because it was, you know, it's a really honored thing, and the Tibetans, that culture, they really know how to take care of teachers, and also Kadampa Center does such a nice job like that. So what he did is there was no water. So he cut his thigh and he dripped the blood so that the dust would not dirty his teacher, like that kind of devotion. Now that's extreme, so I'm not asking anybody to do that, okay? But you get the idea. But just so you know who he is, he was so moved, like so touched by the Dharma, which we don't really have that in our culture. We don't have that kind of faith. We kind of go, well, you know, even the word guru freaks us out. We're like, what does that mean? Somebody's going to take over my mind? No, you're taking over your mind. They're giving you information how to do it properly. Doesn't your mind need some help? Mine does. So I'd like to have somebody that's fully realized help me manage that, okay? And then basically it goes through the Lam Rim. So you recognize some things. Please bless me to see this greatly meaningful body with freedoms and richnesses. Remember those? We talked about those. Okay, goes through that. And then it'll have things in here just so you understand, because it's important to understand what you're saying. Some people go, I don't want to do it. I don't know what they're talking about. Okay. And it talks about, and it just, it's each motivation, each section of the Lam Rim. And to continuously follow day and night the path of the three types of precious trainings. What are the three trainings? Anybody? I know things are broken up into the six of this and the seven of that and the three of that, and it's like, it's confusing in the beginning. Anybody have an idea of the three higher trainings?
The Eightfold Path?
Not the Eightfold Path, but it's contained in that. It's contained in that. So you've got a basis of renunciation. So that's the three principal aspects of the path. And people often get them mixed up. Three principal aspects of the path also take you through the entire Lam Rim, starting with renunciation. And that's what the lotus flowers in these pictures represent. All these images sit on a lotus, okay, because the lotus rises unstained out of the swamp, clean, pristine. And so renunciation is you're emerging from your kaka. You're suffering, and you kind of go, I'm done. You know, haven't you had a pattern? You've perpetuated a negative pattern in your life. And one day you kind of go, I'm so sick of that. I can't do that anymore, you know. I am not going to be raiding the freezer and devouring that whole half gallon of ice cream in one sitting, or you're doing intimate relationships. This was my thing. Intimate relationships in a certain way, and enough making mistakes like that, and one day I just went, no, I can't do that anymore. That's the beginning of renunciation. where you're getting tired of your suffering. That's renunciation. Not giving all your money away and get when you get tired of your suffering. So when you've realized renunciation, then you strive day and night to get out of samsara. That's real renunciation. So the three principal aspects of the path, or the three principles of the path, are renunciation, bodhicitta, and emptiness. Renunciation, bodhicitta, and emptiness. So also you see these images. It's a little hard on some of them, but there's a white disc they sit on. That's the moon disc of bodhicitta, relative bodhicitta. Sometimes there's a golden sun, and that's ultimate bodhicitta, emptiness, the wisdom realizing emptiness. So that's what all the images tend to sit on, because that's representing the path, the three principles of the path. But the three higher trainings, I'll take questions in a little later, the three higher trainings are ethical morality, good conduct. We just talked about steering away from the 10 non-virtues. Ethical conduct. And when I have good morality, meaning I'm leading a pretty ethical life, you know, then I can develop meditative stabilization. That's the second one. Okay. Because it's hard to meditate if you know you stole something from somebody, I kill insects, I lie to people. It's hard for the mind to get settled in meditation, to have good meditation. But once I have shine, calm abiding, meditative absorption, I need that to apply that to the wisdom realizing emptiness, to have a direct perception of emptiness. And that's the third higher training, emptiness. Ethical morality, concentration, wisdom. So you need the wisdom to get enlightened, and I can't get the wisdom without having shine, without having the meditative absorption to focus on it in meditation. And I can't have good samadhi and good meditative absorption till my mind somewhat settled because I'm leading an ethical life. Okay? Everybody with me? It fits together. It makes sense. So I just wanted to say the three types of precious trainings. I think most of the rest of this you understand. And what's also nice is, so then you're reading these verses, and some of them could be a stretch for people when it says, for beings to use for their pleasure, even if they always kill me, criticize me, beat me, and so forth, I'll let them do whatever they like. Okay. We're talking about high-level bodhisattvas. We want to aspire to get to that place because all we do is care for living beings. So at our level, no. This is not about allowing abuse to happen and being a masochist. No. It's not okay to do it. You need to stop that right away if that's happening. But what we're talking about is highly realized states where you're unaffected by any of their criticism or abuse because you're highly realized, but you're there just to benefit them. And sometimes beings, highly realized beings or Buddhas, put themselves in situations where a being might kill them or attack them, and the only reason is they make contact with them. They create some karma with a highly realized being that can benefit that person in the future. Okay, but that's high realization. So don't mistake me. That's high level realization. This is not about you harming yourself or allowing yourself to be harmed. Okay? We're clear? But Rinpoche is kind of setting that up just for the future to think of having the mind like that, that you're undisturbed by that. But again, that takes a very high level. And then it's really nice, this last page, where you're saying, can I be a savior for those who lack a savior, a boat, a ship, a bridge? You know, can I manifest? And when you're a Buddha, you can manifest in any way you like. As an inanimate object, animate object, you can manifest in whatever absolute need for a sentient being to have a connection with them. Any moment you're alive, multiple times you can manifest, multiple emanations. Wouldn't that be great? Because then you have an emanation can come to Kadampa Center. You have an emanation that can be with your partner and be with your kids. You have an emanation that can be on vacation in Hawaii. And an emanation that's on retreat. And like, you know, and you're doing that all at the same time. That's omniscience. It's the omniscient mind. It's hard to conceive of. I know. But I like how we're just saying that I wish, you know, that I could be these things. So it's a wonderful way to start the day, that you're kind of, God, I wish I could be these things, instead of think about how you wake up. What else is going on? And then I really like at the end when it's done, the prayer, and it finishes with the famous line from Master Shantideva that His Holiness loves, as long as space remains, as long as transmigratory beings remain. Transmigratory simply means beings who are cycling in samsara, that's us. We're transmigrating, you know? Until then, may I too remain to dispel the suffering of transmigratory beings, of living beings. One of His Holiness is part of His whole favorite dedication. So, and then I like where Rinpoche has some quotes at the end from Milarepa's heart disciple, Gampopa, who was saying, to think, today I'm going to use my body, speech, and mind, and virtue for sentient beings. Right? You know, and then I get off on my morning activities. But today, so at least I have that in the mind, an imprint there. And at 11 o'clock in the morning, some hours later, I forgot. But then I'm like, oh, wait a minute. Right, that's my cushion. That was there. That making an imprint in my mind of that. So, there it is, the method. Okay.
You said you could find this on the
FPMT.org. And if you go to the shop, you can search for it there. It's really now, if you go to Rinpoche's advice, you can also click on the link right there. And I think you download it. It might even be free to download, or you make a donation. You can make a donation to the shop or FPMT. It's always good for you to make some sort of donation if you like. And you just download it right onto your devices.
What's it called again?
The Method to Transform a Suffering Mind into Happiness.
Yeah, it's in the bookstore too.
There you go. And sometimes they call it, like now they're calling it, referring to it as the method. This is the method. This is it. I think what he's trying to do now, this is what I've noticed since 2011 when he manifested a stroke. He teaches very differently now since before 2011. And there's an urgency. And it just feels like, based on this degenerate time that we're in right now, we need to get down to it. And we look at our planet. There's some serious things happening. So I think he's condensing everything to make it as simple as possible for us, because we're not practicing. More and more people I'm finding are not practicing, not the way they were 20 years ago, those that were at it 20 years ago. So that's a sign of a degenerate time, like that. But those that are, and they said it's like slipping through the eye of a needle. It's a very small space, but if you're really going for it, you can get through there and make bigger strides right now because of the degenerate time. So that's also exciting, I think. So it's something to think about, like that. Okay. So I just wanted, I felt it was important to bring that in, because it's something that can also help the planet right now. Path to Joy from our book of Joy. Let me get out of this. Here we go. The next pillar is forgiveness. And one thing I want to address, but just before that, in looking in a little reflection in your non-joyful episode, could you make some adjustments? Was there a little adjustment that shifted anything? Were you stuck? Are you stuck in it? Is anybody stuck? Where it's like I couldn't really figure out what to do? How's it going for you? I'm just curious. Anybody care to say? And, oh, this is good.
So I couldn't pick just one. but it's hard. I mean, I don't know if it's a stuck thing, but there's always point, counterpoint to understand what's the most beneficial. And so it's just hard. It's hard to figure out, especially when it's really complicated,
mm-hmm.
what's best for whom. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And what does the good outcome look like? And mm-hmm. So it's at work. Mine was in my professional content. And
okay.
And so it's just kind of hard, right? And then I think you're absolutely right. I own it. It's hard. Like, my practice isn't what it used to be. And so I kind of own that. And so now I'm motivated to hear this, actually. This is very motivating. But it's very true from my experience what you're saying.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to make people feel guilty. So
I'm just owning it, right?
Yeah, no, thank you. I own my own thing of what, you know. But it's more, and Rinpoche is really pounding us now. He's not letting us out. I mean, he's, like, sometimes his voice will, some of you have heard this, his voice will change into this, how can I describe, I'm not trying to scare you off, but, I mean, this is really the qualified guru. This is somebody, all he wants is your freedom. And he's desperate to kind of get you engaged. To say, you know, he can't do it for us. But, you know, so his voice will change almost into a kind of, and I'm not criticizing Rinpoche, but like a demonic kind of, you know, you need to do this. Like, but it wakes me up. Like, I'm kind of like, whoa. Like, I need to, okay, thank you. Like, I'm awake now. Like, because he's trying to stress how important it is. And we've touched the path. So he can't deal with all the people that haven't. They're, you know, forget, you know, people. They're like, you're doing what? In a Buddhist center? Huh? Like, what? Like, they're not going to walk in here. That's okay. They can be good people, too. It's not that they're not good people, but now we've connected, and you found really the perfect person. If you make any connection to Rinpoche, you also have Geshe Gelug here. It's wonderful, very different manifestation. But between the two of them, you don't need anybody else. You can also look at teachings with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. They're all online. Books you read. There's your triple jewel. That's it. You've got the perfect package. There's nothing you need to go looking for. You know, now it's a personal situation, so certainly sort out your own thing, but you've got it. You've got the perfect alignment of the planets, right? It's just, now what do I want to do with it? So can I step it up a little bit? Can I figure out how come I'm not doing as much as I was? Or what, you know, like, really, it's you and your practice to figure out what are the obstacles and what does prevent me from doing it. And so even in your work situation, you're saying, can you keep bringing in, again, the very end of that, you know, can I direct, you know, be a benefit? Can I use my body, speech, and mind today in virtue? So if I'm just going to insert that. But then look at these pillars of joy. We're going to talk about four more, you know, and in the situation, suddenly I notice, oh, I'm a little tweaked, and this is happening. And so what's my perspective?
That was the perspective.
Yeah, do I have the proper perspective?
Get out of the weeds.
Yeah, get out of the weeds, exactly. And it's like, wait a minute. Oh, wait, there's all these trees here. Well, I wasn't seeing it. I was here stuck in the... Oh, okay. And then that brings some humility. Like, wow, I'm so focused on myself and my little... You know, and then the humor comes from that. You know, and then I have more acceptance of the whole thing. And acceptance of myself. Like, hey, I'm... So it suddenly... It can lighten up, right? Somebody, yeah, Andre?
It's always a difficult one.
Andre?
To the mouth, right? Yeah. This is always a difficult one for me, right? Because I am stuck in certain places. And although I am really wedded to Buddhism, you know, like I always say, I've drunk the Kool-Aid, you know, there's no issue there. But I do find that my practice has waned a bit. I find that I tend to watch more TV. And so it's not so much the computer games and stuff. That's not really my thing. Although I can get caught up into that too, some card games and stuff. But TV, I can watch six shows, right, nonstop. Hour show, that's about 6 hours of my day, right?
Mm-hmm.
When I could have been up in my gompa, I could have been meditating, I could have been studying, I could have been doing those kinds of things. So it's really difficult. I know I need to get out of that. I need to get advice, but I hate to ask advice if I'm not going to follow it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And so then I tend to beat myself up
mm-hmm.
all the time.
Yep.
And so then I find myself in that rut. you know? And so then I think, like Pema Chodron says, lighten up and so forth and relax. But then I find that I'm too relaxed. I'm not, you know,
yep.
I'm not urging myself to, yep. Yeah, you know what I'm saying?
So, I mean, I think most people get into that. Most people are in that space of, so, okay, so great that you've identified. What if you take an hour of the six? Not all six.
Shows I like.
What, you know? I know, it's a shame that TV now has quality things on it. You know, like there's some interesting things that, you know, I've watched a little bit of TV lately. I don't watch a lot. But some things I saw and I was really like, well, that was really thought-provoking. Like that was interesting and well done. But that's the thing is priorities. Make it, because what happens is when you start getting into the mode and you don't feel good, and you notice if I just did an hour of the, and that pulled a little bit of an hour away from that into the practice, you feel better. The guilt isn't there, you feel happier. It's an instant gratification. There's no question about it. So it takes a little bit of effort, and I know somebody I'm working with now that was saying like, so I'm doing all these prayers, and then we get a little bored and we kind of go, what are we doing these for? I could be, but you do it, and you know, because it's guidance from a proper master like Lama Zopa Rinpoche, or, you know, this is what we've been told from the Buddha and all these things, the Dalai Lama saying the same thing, then we generate some faith in that. And you know when you do it, you feel better. You do feel. So can I invest that into the thing, pry myself out of the chair with the remote in my hand, turn it off, and say, okay, I'm going up for 1 hour so that I can then have the 2 hours to watch what I want to watch.
Wean yourself off slowly, like a drug.
That's what I would do. I mean, some people are cold turkey. That's fine. And one thing I experimented after my dad moved out of the house, he had cable TV. Well, it's expensive. And I have to start paying those bills. And I'm not a TV watcher. And so there was something. I was away, and I called them up. And you know how those companies get you. Well, you got the triple play. You got, you know, I was like, the what? Like, but you have this, and so if you drop something, each thing wasn't that much on its own, but it's all packaged together, and you know, it's too expensive. So I was going away right around then, and I said, and they had to suspend. You can suspend it, the service, for free. Or no, you pay one fee, $50, and I could suspend it up to 9 months a year. So I said, well, I'm going to suspend it just to see what it's like to not have the landline and the TV. I needed the internet, but I could suspend two of them, and they, you know, whatever it was, and then all the bills are free. There's zero. So I noticed the only calls I get on the landline are junk. So I wasn't answering the landline anyway, but I'd sometimes look at the screen and be like, no, it's spam, it's spam, it's spam. So now the phone doesn't ring. So quiet, peaceful. And I'm mostly dealing with this. Okay, TV was gone. So yeah, it's easy to take a remote if you have cable and just, oh, what's on? Okay. But, and occasionally when my dad was home, I would do that and I found the laziness and suddenly an hour would go by and I'd be like, oh, I'm watching some junkie. So that was ended because there was no TV. Right? So then if you want, you can buy a Netflix thing or whatever if you have one of those TVs and put that on or watch it on your computer. If there was something I wanted to watch, you know, there was something I think I wanted to watch. My brother told me about a show and something I watched a little of. But I have control over that, not paying very much for it like that. So, and what happened is now the house, like I don't have the habit of putting the TV on. It wasn't there. I don't hear it. I heard it with my father all the time. He had it on all the time. So you kind of got in a thing, and sometimes I come in and I go, what are you watching? You know, because the TV, it sucks you in. I have a terrible time with it. I noticed years ago in San Francisco, I was doing this AIDS hospice work and they would match you. I was an emotional support counselor and they matched me. So the guy I was with for 2 years, who became a good friend, he always had the TV on in his house and I didn't have TV at my apartment where I lived with a couple women. So I'd go over and if it was on in the living room and there we were, I had to put my back to it because I couldn't focus on him because I'd be like, it's just a little box and it was just, that's just the effect. So I found like I really didn't want to have it in the space because it would hypnotize me and pull me in and then I'd be like, oh, what's on next? And but then the other thing is, I don't know if you have cable.
Oh, good God.
Good God, okay. So let's check. Let's actually analyze, because this is a problem for a lot of us. Let's analyze it. Do you know what you're paying for with cable?
My wife does. I don't pay attention.
You're paying for commercials.
Yeah.
That's what you're paying for. Commercials. You can watch all that stuff on a streaming thing for less. All those ads. And what do they advertise in the States?
Drugs.
Pharmaceutical drugs. And garbage. You know, and Dodge Ram trucks. Depending on what you're watching, okay? Because I used to watch some baseball games with my dad, and all the ads were Dodge Ram trucks, okay? So be careful. And what happens... But this stuff goes in, more than subtle. It's more than subtle. It goes in. I see people go to the doctor, I want that thing, I saw it on TV. It fixes everything, doesn't it?
No. They tell
you
the side effects.
Yeah. Yeah, the side effects are awful, like that. And in other countries, it's illegal for pharmaceuticals to advertise. Isn't that sane and civilized? Yeah. It's crazy. You know, and this year, be careful. If you're going to put TV on, the political ads.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
I made an unfortunate mistake in when was the last election? 2016? And I was on retreat most of 2015. I came back living with my dad for the first time, actually living full time with him. I'd finished with the center in Vermont. And he has the TV on all the time. And it was the election year. And I was suddenly like, I pulled in February, and I'm like, you know, within 1 week, I'm like, I'm going to shoot myself. I couldn't believe the bombardment. I didn't even watch TV. I could hear it from the next room. Then I got him on wireless headphones that he used like half the time. It's a small house, right? So again, really check up what you are being distracted. You are being, your brain is being taken over. Okay? You are being brainwashed. Okay, we don't like to use those words, but you know, but hey, you're being brainwashed. If you've got that stuff coming in and it starts telling you, oh, you need to do that, this is what, you know, and it's over and over and over and over. The advertisers know how to get you, and you don't need that in your mind. It makes your mind not peaceful. That's how it's done to my mind. So I stopped it. It's your choice. I don't need it. Right? Saving a lot of money. I'm not going to pay money for that. It's so peaceful in the house, you know. And then if you really want to watch something, you can do it. Now, in our generations, we're not as skilled with the streaming. But you learn. You learn, and then it's good for your mind to learn if you want to do it. It's not a big deal. It's not a big deal. You can learn how to do it, and you're empowered to do it, and then suddenly you're saving $100 a month, right? So you can donate to Kadampa Center. Right? But it's true. It's really true that, so again, it takes a little bit of getting out of my lazy kind of, oh, but it's always on. I don't really want to deal with the company. And, you know, I have to be on hold for a long time. And then you sort it and you do it. And you're in a new space. So it's tricky, but you can do it. You can do it, Andre. I know you can.
Yeah. Well, I've gotten really, really clever with it now because I don't watch the commercials. I record everything.
Great. So okay. That's better.
I'm getting pure show, right?
so that's a better way to do.
Yeah.
Good.
But still, it's time consuming.
It's very time consuming.
Yeah, and I know I could be using the time more effectively, and I should be using it more.
And then also, do you ever notice how you feel after 3 hours of TV?
Yeah.
I have no energy.
Yeah.
I really don't have any energy, and I also find it hard to sleep. If it's evening stuff. Even the little girl said, I watched something exciting. Anybody knows that. It just somehow that it's like, mm-hmm. What's that? You do want to? You want to bake? Oh. To want to bake. Okay. I never thought of baking, but okay. But I just noticed I feel really numb and drained after too much TV. And then I can't do anything. So it's like a double whammy. And then how many of you like to eat when you watch TV?
Snacks.
Fruit salads. A few years ago, and I just noticed my sister and I were joking about, don't you have binge eating times? Do you ever notice your own, body makeup? Her time is 4 to 6 in the evening. And sometimes we'll, she's in England, but sometimes we'll talk at that time, and she'll say, oh, and I'll say, are you having your popcorn? I'll say to her, and I'll say, and that's when she watches some, she'll take a break and watch TV or something, and she'll say, she'll go, well, this is my eating time, I have to stay out of the kitchen, and for me, it's 10 p.m. to midnight.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a late night person, and that's when I want to eat. So if I get in bed by 10, which I do, I'm trying more and more, if I brush my teeth at 8 p.m., that's it. I'm not, like, be skillful and put some idea. We have to be practical. So I just know that if, when I'm up late working, it's just a good time. I can stay up often, go to bed at 1 or 2. And I'm working, that's when I want to eat something. And then if you put me in front of a TV show, oh my goodness.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not even hungry. I've just eaten, but I just, it's a habit. So I notice the habit. Be smart with yourself. So I'll have a thing, I'm not eating past 8, and I brush my teeth. If I brush my teeth, I won't eat after that. So I already know, no, brush your teeth. We're done. That's it. You know, but also if I get away from the screen, I don't really want to eat. I don't need to eat. It's more if you put me in front of the screen, then it used to be in the old days for me, in a bar I needed to have a cigarette. I had a habit. You know, I occasionally smoked cigarettes years ago. Years and years. So when we could drink, if I was drinking, then that was the only time I wanted to have a cigarette like that. So there's habits like that. Do you notice? So can we be stronger to notice if that's one of your things? And I would say slightly adjusting and stealing an hour or two of those programs. Make a decision. Don't watch so many programs. Let it go. Let it go. Your life is fine without them.
Yeah.
Possible?
Possible. Yeah.
You can do this.
I believe it. Yeah, and I have done it in spurts. You know.
Yeah.
You know, I just say, well, yeah, I'm going to cut down on this, but then I found myself back going there again because I really do enjoy TV. To me, it's like if it's a good story, it's like reading. You know, my wife reads a lot, and then she has this thing. Well, why don't you read? You're wasting your time. I'm saying, spend the same amount of time. She reads. And I watch TV.
But reading is different. I really
she tells
find,
me that. I'm not sure.
I really find reading... I find it different. It exercises a different part of my brain.
Yeah.
I'm not drained after reading, even though I can read in bed at night and it makes me go to sleep sometimes, which is fine. But I find it exercises a different, more creative, visual kind of where the TV, you're like...
It's because you're given the visual and you don't create it yourself.
Right. Yeah, so I find that the reading stimulates more. You learn more vocabulary. You more, you know, and there's some TV shows are real garbage out there. So you have to, if you want to watch something, okay, I've gotten a little, I've only seen a few of these, but Black Mirror. Anybody watch that? It's like the modern day tech Twilight Zone. I don't know. It's very creative, very interesting, but I really don't watch a lot of TV, so... But a little bit. So think about it. Think about what, you know, later I'll ask you what you're watching and then I'll make adjustments in your programming and say, no, Andre.
Well, see, I put it out there now. So
But that's good to really think about. I mean, this is practically the work we have to do, to be honest about it, is because those are the big time wasters. I find people's screen time with garbage is the biggest time waster of all, whether it's your computer, a device, a tablet, your phone. Everybody's on there streaming something. And what are you streaming? You know, for me, like somebody will send me a link. You got to watch this video. That's some interesting talk about something. But then somehow, you know, other things pop up. And, well, like I said before, when I get to the dancing cat videos, I know, turn it off. That's like, stop.
Back,
like,
back.
Yeah. You go back and suddenly I'm like, what am I watching? Like, huh? You know, I went in to look at Mingyur Rinpoche something, and now I'm in the dancing cat videos. Didn't take long. So, please.
Okay.
Oh, sorry. Wait, next. You're next. Yeah. Hold that thought.
Me? Okay. I was going to mention something about when you talk about going to the unpleasant situation.
Yes, and the non-joyful place.
Non-joyful. And to me, I don't normally feel being stuck, because I always find the answer is within me.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I'm stuck, when I try to blame somebody else or something else, and as soon as I get to the unpleasant or unjoyful situation, I have to sit and meditate and find what was in within me that kind of agitated me, or to react like that, to feel sad or to feel angry or frustrated. And also, I'm from Iran, and recently we had a chaos going on between the United States and Iran. And
you're from Iran?
Yes.
Oh, I thought you were. I was going to think Spanish speaking. Okay.
No.
Sorry,
so,
my ear.
Called Persian. So anyway, for me, it's looking at the situation. I always look at it as something is been going on always.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what we see is not that we are going through a extremely chaos. It's been always chaos. First of all, in Middle East where we live, we have oil and we have a resource. So for us, being chaos is normal.
Yeah.
So for always tell my friends, if there is nothing happening, I get nervous.
Mm-hmm.
For us, it's normal to be chaos. But in the other hand, I look at it that it's been always like that in the history.
Mm-hmm.
It's always one that they have power try to take advantage of one that they don't have.
Right.
And a bunch of people that they don't have any skill to be on the top, they are on the top. And then the knowledge, the one that they have a knowledge and a skill, they are not doing anything. But
right.
I try to accept it. This is what it is. I'm not going to allow it to make me angry or frustrated, even though it's very hard. Because when it hit home, and when I'm worried about my family and friends back home, but then I go back to my practice more and more and more and more, and realize that that's the only way out. That's the only way that I can come to some sense and be okay and be calm. So I agree with you that the practice is the way of our coming out of situation and be okay with whatever is happening around us, and always find the answer when I'm stuck within myself.
Thank you.
That's blaming others.
That's great. Now you got to work on this guy. Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
So I totally relate to Andre. I'm with you, man. And this is what I struggle with is, rationally, we know the path. We know the benefits of practice. And yet we still get sucked into other things. And, you know, part of it is the design of TV or the internet or whatever. We can all, you know, analyze it. I think a lot of us are educated enough to, you know why it's addictive or at times suck. But the thing is, even though I know practice is beneficial or coming to Kanapa Center is beneficial, it's still a struggle to actually, I guess, do the work, do the practice. And I guess I'm asking, is it just laziness, or is there another reason that even though you know something is good for you and you'll come out on the other side, you know, happier or better or whatever, you still go down the negative path, or you waste time on negative things?
I think a lot of it is laziness and the habit of not doing it and not doing it enough to see the results, see some positive results. And then I think a symptom of the degenerate time, which contributes to the laziness. Mm-hmm. So I think it's also that. And I think just looking in around the room right now, I would encourage you, honestly, because Americans can respond like this, is, and we're not all Americans in here, but in this culture, is find a buddy in the room of somebody you don't know. Now, if there is a couple, you could probably, if you're pretty disciplined, do it together. But find somebody you don't know, like if it's you and Andre, and you guys make a pact together. that this is what we're going to work on to do. Like, and I just give an example. You don't have to do this prayer, but yeah, for the next week, and it's almost like a 12-step thing. Let's do the prayer every morning, individually, in your homes. You do it separately, but you call each other later in the day. So you have like a check-in of, you know, and you feel a little embarrassed if I didn't do it. And you've got to kind of say, well, how come you didn't do it? And you say to him, well, wait, what's the deal? Come on, let's make a deal and 1 hour less on our time-wasting things, whatever they are, because it's not just TV. You know, what, let's make a pact. You and I have a deal. And it used to be years ago, like a girlfriend and I did a diet once together. So it really helped us, because when I was like, oh, you know, I just want the peanut M&Ms, she's like, no, come on. And then she was going to lapse, and I went, no, you don't need the ice cream right now. Remember, we're... So it helps to have a buddy. And I think that would be a really neat experiment to, you know, to think about, do you want a buddy up in here? And I'm happy to buddy you up right now in this room, because it'll go and you walk out the room and you won't do it. So again, the laziness, you're not going to do it. The laziness will take you and you go, oh, that's a really good idea. Yeah, okay, well, back in my car. So it would be neat to kind of identify and say, yep. You know, I could point to people and go, you and you and you. And then you meet each other, exchange phone numbers, emails, text, whatever you want to do. Maybe it's just a text. Hey, Andre, the method. Ding, ding, ding. Remember? Like, it make fun with it. Add the humor in to see, because I bet you'll end up doing a lot more stuff. And you experiment. And maybe make an experiment for a month. You're going to try it for a month. And maybe you switch partners after a month.
You're going to die at six.
What's that?
You're
going to
die at six.
Yeah, no, so I think that's... I don't know. What do you guys think? Do you want to try something? Do you want to try a little revolutionary? Or who would like to try it? How many people in here? Let me just... 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 13. There's 14 people put their hands up. Seven pairs.
Charlie.
Okay, great. We got seven. Can I pair you up? Because I'm kind of... I mean... Keep your hand up. Those who want to do it. Okay. I got you guys. So you're gonna exchange. I've got I've got your name, Dwight. Dwight. What's your name? Right there.
Okay, Samara.
Samara? Can you guys you're okay? What's your name?
Meredith.
But you're committed to kind of, you understand what I'm talking about. In this tradition, just so that we're clear, that it's not kind of like, oh, well, I'm going to do this prayer. And let's just say the method, if you do that every morning, but maybe just it's a little bit of my gratitude practice in the morning, motivation. You guys make a deal what you want to do. But something related to this stuff, right? Does that sound okay? And then, okay, I've got you two right here in the back. Yeah, what's your name?
Susan.
Susan and?
Lily.
Lily. Okay. Who else has their hand up?
Jason.
Chip. You guys okay to? And I've got Rebecca and Donna. How's that? Who's missing? Who has their hand up? Karen and Jill.
We've tried this before already.
You already? Okay. Who are we missing?
Laura.
I'm so sorry. But you're teamed up with somebody, no? Oh, I didn't. Okay. Meredith and Laura. Meredith and Laura? Cool. Okay, so...
It works. A friend of mine,
Well, wait, let me go on, because we're kind of running out of time. So,
okay.
What I wanted to say is, I mean, it is nice to make some consistency. So, if you... You guys are going to do it, right? Holding you to it. Okay. No, I already know. So what if, what do you think about the method, what we read this morning?
Really verbose.
Very verbose, yeah. Lama Zopa Rinpoche style. Verbose. Okay. So what about the morning practices I gave of gratitude in the morning, your own thinking about your good circumstances, thinking about your own The prayers do help, though, I have to say. The prayers turn your mind. They're a support for the mind. You know, so there's some balance of things. But I also had, are you doing a motivation of reflecting on your good circumstances?
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, heck no.
Okay. Reflecting on your good qualities? Come on, girl. Reflecting on death and impermanence. That's a 5-minute thing in the morning. Waking up in bed and then setting a good motivation. But that's pretty short. So I think some a little additional thing. But if you can first get that started, is everybody clear on that? And most of you have heard it. If your partner hasn't heard it, explain it to them, and they can listen again to the recording of when I explained it Friday night, and I think Saturday morning we did it like that. Okay? That's a quick 5-minute little thing. And then what I would suggest is if those of you that like the method and want to commit to doing that every morning, which comes right after that, you know, that's 10 minutes mainly. There's mantras that, again, go on. If you need to learn those, some people in here can show you, explain what those are. So that would be really nice. That's advice from Lama Zopa Rinpoche. And then if you're not doing that, some 5-minute sitting practice. And there's meditations on the clarity of consciousness, on the nature of mind. There's some stuff in how to meditate. You could choose a short meditation for the week and just do that one for the week. Same meditation for the week. So Kathleen McDonald, Venerable Sangha Kadro, How to Meditate. Are you familiar with, is everybody familiar with that book? It's a basic, familiar with, okay. She's nodding now. Okay, I got her. Then the choose a meditation between you. Keep it simple. Choose it quickly. Don't make a big, like, well, maybe that one. Just choose one because you're going to go through them over time. Choose one. You're doing it for the week. Each of you on your own do it. And a little text later in the day. Hi there. Remember me? How's it going? How's your day? And somebody might say, well, I really blew it. I didn't do it. Okay. Well, what prevented you from doing it? Why don't you have a little check-in with each other? What do you think? Okay. So we've got 7 pairs, and maybe I add you guys as an 8th pair. I've drafted you. Okay. 8 pairs. But what would be kind of neat is I would love if somebody wanted to report back to one person. We could choose a person if there's somebody there. You could send a text to that person how it's going, like once a week or once a month. It'd be a neat story for Mandala.
You can report to me.
You sure, Donna? Okay, so Donna, write. I want you to write down right now, Donna's, do you want a text or an email?
Email. Everybody knows my email. Program.donna.
Okay, everybody got Donna's email. Okay, in the back, she doesn't have your email.
Okay, I'll give it to you.
Wait, so it's program?
Program.
Dot?
Donna, D-O-N-N-A, at Kadampa-Center, and that's American Center, E-R, dot O-R-G.
And we just want to let her know that we're doing it or not.
So what I would recommend is after 2 weeks, let it go for 2 weeks. Try your best. Well, some days you're going to forget. You're going to mess it up and just say, look, I am going to get to it tomorrow, then say to your partner. But you do need a little daily check-in with your partner. Okay, it doesn't have to be long. Wait, one second. Daily check-in with your partner. After 2 weeks, one of you decide, I'm going to report back to Donna, and just tell her how you're feeling. Let's go, the two of you, you know, hey, it's working. I'm watching 2 hours less of TV. I'm actually doing the practice. I'm now doing another meditation, too. I read this book. I'm now going, let them know just general how you're feeling. One or two sentences. Don't send her a long email. Just, she's busy. But, you know, a short thing. And then I want to know how it's going.
Yeah.
So then I'm really going to be checking. Okay? I want to know. I want to take care of your mind. I want you to take care of your mind. Please. No, but I think it's really cool, and I think we need some support. And when you have to kind of say to somebody else, and I've got a buddy, and my buddy's counting on me to keep them boosted, And I'm counting on them to stay boosted, and they're counting on me. So you got a little deal going with these people. So don't let your buddy down. Okay, but if you do, don't feel guilty about it. Just get on the horse the next day and say, yep, okay, you're right, I got to do this. Let's see what happens. Let's see what happens. We might start a revolution in FPMT, and then everybody will be practicing again.
Yay.
Okay, yay! And as Rinpoche says, like, okay, I think today's the Super Bowl. Is that right? Anybody have any favorite teams?
No.
No, okay, good. Equanimity, right? I don't even know. I found out yesterday who's playing. I didn't really focus. Anyway, the ex-Philly, the ex-Eagles manager is in it, apparently. I don't know. I never really watched it so much. But so it's tonight. So Rinpoche says, some of you might be watching it and go to a party or something. And Rinpoche would say, you get into your sports team, whatever, and sometimes you have a favorite sports team, right? And then Rinpoche says, then the way you cheer for your sports team, you cheer for your enlightenment. And Rinpoche did that. It was so cute one day. Light of the Path, he was like, you know, and it's like that. And you get into it, and you get juiced, and you're all going to juice everybody else up, and they're going to be like, what are they doing? How come they're so excited? Right? Well, I got my buddy, and I'm doing my practice. So I'm invigorated, I'm energized, and watch out, because you're going to be happier. Be careful, you're going to be happier.
I'm so scared.
You're going to be great. You're going to totally kick it out, you know? So it's so funny because there's certain terms that I've really tried to get out of my vocabulary. Be careful. Like terms like kill the light. Will you kill the light? Would you shoot me an email? I try to get those terms out. But there is this expression now, you know, she's killing it.
Yeah.
You know, like that's, I try to, you know, but it's kind of, I understand what that means. Like it's a fun thing of, so anyway, you're going to totally be doing it, girl. Totally got it. So, okay, so thank you very much, because now it's to energize me. You know, because there's nothing like when you're teaching, you have some great folks out there, and then you say something, and you go, okay, so the 8 freedoms and the 10 riches, and it's just deer in the headlights. You know, they're like, huh, what? What's she talking about? I've only heard it 57 times, you know. And so this way, it'll be interesting what you can begin learning and relearning in your practice, and you will be happier. You will be more peaceful, right? You will be more joyful. That's what you want. And you won't be saying, like, how come I'm not, you know, because you'll be doing it. You won't have that guilt around the edges. And other people will look and go, what's she doing? What's he doing? I want that. Contagious. Okay? You had a question?
It was probably a practical question. Like, Donna, you have a microphone, but it was just if people are streaming and wanted a buddy, could they email you? Because Chris says we have
the streaming buddies. Yes.
People watching right now.
Six people? Do they want? Do any of them want buddies?
No pressure.
What's that? That's what I just said. Does anybody streaming want a buddy? Want to participate in this exercise?
No comments.
Okay. And I think it's kind of something. Yeah. Anyway, but it's good to be in person to kind of be like, hey, you guys, you see each other, you talk to each other. At some point, that could be revisited. But thank you, Donna, for taking the email. Thank you all for participating. And we'll give it our best shot. And thank you very much. So we have an hour left. So what I'd like to talk about is the other four pillars. And, okay. After acceptance, so we went through perspective, humility, humor, and acceptance. Acceptance, I find, is linked to forgiveness. Forgiveness is the first pillar of the heart that's more related, coming from the heart. The first four were kind of the mind, how the mind functions with joy. Forgiveness, from His Holiness the Dalai Lama, where the wrong action is concerned, it may be necessary to take appropriate counteraction to it, to stop it. Toward the actor or the person, however, you can choose not to develop anger and hatred. This is where the power of forgiveness lies. It's very powerful yourself when somebody's harming you or your loved ones or somebody, or somebody's interfering with your agenda in a very nasty way, and you're aware of what's happening. You're watching it unfold, right? You may try to prevent some of it as best as you can in a least harmful way, okay? But, and then there's a switch in you, and suddenly, and you might notice irritation arising and frustration and anger start manifesting, and suddenly you've added in some teachings on karma, which says in my mind, so if I get angry back now, and not even back, but if I just choose anger as a path, that creates negative imprints in my mind that are going to cause me to suffer in the future. And because everything's empty, that means that there's really no concretely existing perpetrator, interferer, aggressor out there. I will try to protect my child right now because somebody is coming this way or whatever, but they don't really exist like that for all time, that person. They come from other things. Karma is also a factor in this, in that myself and my child have right now negative seeds ripening to possibly have us harmed. So acknowledging, again, the bigger picture. You know, it's not just us and them and me and this horrible person and they're terrible and this is it and all we have to do is protect ourselves. There's a bigger thing out there that really, for the benefit of all humankind, if I can choose not to be angry but de-escalate this situation as best as I can, okay, fantastic. So there can be this switch sometimes where you decide not to choose anger. And it's a huge space of practice for you. Huge space of practice. So not losing sight of the humanity of the person who may be harming you, while responding to the wrong with clarity and firmness from His Holiness the Dalai Lama. It doesn't mean you don't take action, right? But with clarity and firmness. It's the same thing. Your young child, you see a young child running out into the street and a bus is coming or a car is coming, okay? You're going to run out and grab them very firmly by the arm, pulling them back to the curb, and then you may say something to them like this, very strongly and loudly and emphatically, okay? You don't hate the kid. They didn't know any better. Little kids like that, they dart out. They don't know. They're chasing the ball. They don't, you know. But you are going to make sure that you are clear how you express yourself, that you cannot do that ever again. That is not okay. Absolutely. You will get killed. Okay? So you're emphasizing things. So then we know, and we grow up as children knowing, like, okay, that's not an okay thing to do. Same thing if your kid is lying or stealing, or we have these episodes where things happen like that. So you might raise your voice, but not, you're not angry. You're just trying to make a point to instill some values in the same thing. And the same thing in you're at work and there's a sexual harassment thing going on, or you're just finding that there's some unethical conduct at work. Somebody's stealing something. Somebody's lying to people. Somebody's not taking care of employees in a certain way. Okay? What do you do? Well, I don't need to be angry at them, okay, because I don't want to, again, lose sight of their humanity. People suffer from delusion. That's why they lie and steal and don't understand. None of us have a direct perception of emptiness if you're a sentient being. So how can we not have compassion from that space? Meaning, if they don't have a direct perception of emptiness, everything they're engaging in and seeing is tainted, is flawed with the wrong view. I'm not saying you're bad. I'm just saying that's reality. So if my boss has something tainted from the wrong view, and because of that they might have an idea that lying to clients is a good thing, and they want everybody to do it, then it's my job to, at some point, check out how that's sitting with other people in my office first, before I leap. Check it out. Develop a good relationship with my boss. Things take time, over time. And then slowly at some point when I think I've gained some faith, with people have faith in me in the company, my boss likes me, this, maybe privately one day I go into my boss and tell them how I feel about doing this. that I'm not comfortable with this and I don't think it's really best for our business overall. Maybe I can even give examples from other companies that got really clean ethically and how successful they were. You know, and then it's a choice. Your boss might say, well, this is what we're doing. Or they might say, well, let me think about that. And then it's my choice whether to continue working there or to find another job slowly over time. But that's, and then let it go. Like I've said my thing. And maybe it's somebody you can approach so you get a few staff people with you to find a constructive way. You're not ganging up on somebody. You're not ambushing people. Not coming from the angry, spiteful, belligerent mode. But with compassionate wisdom, figuring out how can we intervene? They seem to value us as employees. We love what we're doing. We love the company. We really want to stay here. We'd like to make it better. That's the motivation. And then go in and discuss with the board or a team or something. Occasionally we don't know who to go to, but we have found the ear of this one board member who seems to be, okay. Then you go to that board member. There's some people that might feel ganged up or they went behind my back, but this is not a functional situation. So that's how we'd work in it, but I don't have to choose anger because I know we're all doing our best. And because we suffer from delusion, people make mistakes. So they choose stealing, lying, inappropriate behavior, like that. Okay, but those things eventually are not good. So if you can try to intervene in a compassionate way by remembering, not losing sight of their humanity. They're human. They suffer from the same delusions you do. We've mucked it up as well. We've messed up, okay? We stand firm against the wrong, not only to protect those who are being harmed, but also to protect the person who's harming others. Because eventually the person harming others is going to suffer too. So a bigger place of your mind and practice is, let's say you're pissed off at somebody in your community, family, or workplace. This person's just a jerk. I don't really want anything to do with them. But what happens is I'm very focused on how they make me feel, not good. It's all about me. Okay? How do you make them feel? Did you ever think about that? Maybe they're intimidated by you, and that's why they act the way they do. So on some level, again, I mentioned the creating healthy relationships overall, but I find this person really challenging, okay? But what if I notice that there's a certain behavior that I'm perpetuating that totally pisses them off, right? Causes them to do negative stuff, then a bigger level of practice is I need to watch my behavior. First of all, my mind that creates my behavior. Why? Because the angrier they get at me, the more they suffer, now and in future lives. How about that? It's a big stretch for your enemy or the person you don't like. You know, I can't control their mind and take care of their mind, but in a little sense, it's an offering you give them. Is I'm really got to watch my mind around them and my behavior because it's creating such negative stuff in their minds, creating a hell rebirth for them because every time they see me, they get angry. And that's what I love about the method. Because it has a saying, anybody who criticizes me, anybody who says, you know, may they be happy. Like, what an amazing thing to think about. Like, that stuff, doing it every day, it transforms your mind. Kind of automatically transforms your mind. You don't have to be any great meditator. But just those verses, which sound so adverse to us, like anybody who criticizes me and talks about me and harms me, and I'm supposed to think that they're a precious jewel, and this is mind training. That's what we're doing in Buddhism. If that resonates with you, that's what you want to do is take those ordinary conceptions. He's hurting me. I should get him back. That's United States of America. Right? That doesn't work, that kind of stuff. Doesn't make people happy. It makes people alienated. Look what happens in the Middle East. That's the story of the Middle East. Right? A rocket is lobbed from Gaza into Israel. Okay? And then Israel lobs a rocket back into there. And then they lob another... And retaliation, and it's been going on for centuries. And sometimes, as Holiness said one time in relation to the Middle East, of that conflict, sometimes you just have to let the karma burn out. Like, there's really very little you can do because it's just back and forth. So we don't need to be in that cycle in our own daily lives. Forgiveness. It's out of a sense of concern for their own long-term well-being that we stop their wrongdoing. We're concerned about the other, concerned about the perpetrator, the difficult person. It's a big space of mind for you. Big space of mind. It leads to your happiness when you can get into that mind. Forgiveness, Archbishop Desmond Tutu added, is the only way to heal ourselves and be free from the past. Be free mostly from harm from the past. So he and his daughter wrote the Book of Forgiving I mentioned before. There's some great exercises in there to forgive, long-term things as well. And don't be surprised, he said. He talks about telling your story. This was the truth and reconciliation practice they did in the Republic of South Africa after apartheid ended. And what they did is the people that were tortured, and they were badly tortured, some people. Many were killed. But the ones that survived were allowed to sit in front of their torturer, if the torturer was still alive, and tell the story of how they felt and what happened to their families, their lives, how they were destroyed, and tell them how they were feeling. And then you have a choice to forgive or not forgive. So, but then they forgave. They wanted to forgive them. And then you have a choice at the end to renew your relationship with the person, to continue in a new way, or not to continue the relationship. That's okay. You might have been abused as a child by a family member. The person may be alive or not, but let's say they're alive and you decide at some point, but in a compassionate way. 1970s psychology was all about, if your mother harmed you when you were little and now your mother's 75 years old, you get them back and you tell her how horrible and how horrible she is, and that doesn't do anything. Okay? But if you're able to sit down in a safe space with possibly some safe people with you to explain how you feel, based on what happened, okay, then your choice is to continue a relationship with this person. It's not about anything from their side. It's you letting go of this story, telling it to them in a safe place. If they passed away, you can tell it to them through visualization or tell it to somebody else, this happened to me, that's safe, that can hold that story for you and really listen to you. And then you can choose, I realize that with this person, the more I'm with them and around them, I don't feel safe. They're still abusive. Doesn't work for me. I'm letting it go. I'm letting the relationship go. They'll always be my father, let's say. They'll always be my mother. But I'm not going to choose to have an in-person relationship with them anymore. That's okay. That's okay. Or you might choose, yes, I can. And you might set up some parameters around which you can do it. Okay? But don't be surprised then. You go to sleep at night. Okay? And you wake up the next morning, and you have to forgive again. It's a process, especially with deep trauma, with deep abuse and trauma. It's a process. Forgiveness. And then, this is from His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Oh, and sorry, from the Book of Forgiving. We are bound, from Archbishop Desmond Tutu and his daughter, without forgiveness, we remain tethered to the person who harmed us. We are bound to the chains of bitterness, tied together, trapped. Until we can forgive the person who harmed us, that person will hold the keys to our happiness. That person will be our jailer. When we forgive, we take back control of our own fate and our feelings. We become our own liberator. And to go on with His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, perhaps my behavior, he says, or attitude, or even a facial expression I have, contributed to this person becoming my enemy. He said, so I was also involved. He said, so who's to blame? So sitting and thinking of the different causes and conditions, then you see if we're really angry, we must be angry toward the causes and conditions. Ultimately, their anger, their ignorance, their short-sightedness, their narrow-mindedness. So that brings a sense of concern. Okay. We can feel sorry for these people. So again, when you understand the causes and conditions behind somebody, your boss, having a certain view, a lot of people at the top are very insecure and are very alone at the top. They don't have somebody to kind of share stuff with. They've got their board that's putting pressure on them, but they can't share and air stuff with any of the staff. It's not really appropriate. So who do they talk to? Some of them don't have other people at that level that they can go to. That's a difficult position. And then everybody's got their finger pointed at you. It's your fault. I noticed at Vajrapani, the nature of being a center director with an active center director, especially at places where you live, it's a residence, residential retreat centers, right? When things were going swimmingly well, everybody else took credit, right? And when they weren't going well, everything was my fault, the director. It was amazing. And I remember Venerable Roger, Rinpoche's attendant, when I first got the job at Vajrapani, and they came to the center, and we were walking around the stupa one night, and he said, yeah, it's really helpful. He was trying to give me advice, and he said, it's really helpful to know that the top of your CV or your resume is object of criticism. He said, then it's easier. Then it'll be easier. You know, and I was kind of like, ha-ha. You know, I didn't really listen to him. And then later I was like, oh, he's really right. Like, so it's just human nature that, like that. So, and then some of the researchers in from Book of Joy said they found that a lack of forgiveness, unforgiveness, seems to compromise the immune system. Okay, it includes disrupting the production of important hormones and the way our cells fight off infections. And they say that unresolved anger creates cancer. Some people talk about it like that. I don't really know. I mean, karma's involved as well, Buddhism would say. But that's interesting, I think. It definitely has an effect. Let's go to the next pillar of joy, coming from the heart. We've talked about this before, gratitude. Gratitude, wonderful practice. Acceptance means not fighting reality. Okay? Gratitude means embracing reality. It means moving from counting your burdens to counting your blessings. And it's really a recipe, as I've mentioned before, for appreciating our own lives. This is one I want to bring in. Anthony Ray Hinton. This is the death row inmate, 30 years for a crime he did not commit in Alabama. He was held on death row. Imagine 30 years of your life and nobody believes you and you didn't really have proper representation and racism, you name it, okay? Anthony Ray Hinton, when released from prison, just a minor thing that he said, when he said, people run out of the rain. I run into the rain. How can anything that falls from heaven not be precious? Having missed the rain for so many years, I'm so grateful for every drop just to feel it on my face. Like, think about that. He wasn't allowed outside for 30 years, wasn't in any situation. So just something simple like the rain, and we kind of go, oh, it's raining out, and how grateful he was. Like, you have certain things taken away from you. Like I mentioned just the times at Laudo or the last time when I was cold and I was cold. I came down the mountain. It was December. And then it was just so cold. Finally, I get on the little plane to head down to Kathmandu. I got the last seat on the last flight out the one day. I never left that quickly. So I flew down from Laudo. I was running. I never came down that quickly over a year ago. So we got to Lukla really quickly in the morning. And normally the day you enter Lukla, you can't fly out the same day because the flights start at 7 a.m. and you're too late. And by the time, so the lodge owner that was helping me, because I had already said the day before, I'm coming in, I'm going to be there tomorrow. Can you get me on a flight? Because I don't like to stay in Lukla overnight. And then suddenly he thought I'd be there like at 10:30. But again, I got up early and suddenly at 9 a.m. I'm entering the Lukla gate. I'm quickly texting him going, I'm in Lukla now. And he goes, okay, go to the airport. So the last flight, it was very tricky because the flights were filled. And 12:30 p.m., we took off. I got in the last seat of the last flight, 12:30. And I'm in the plane and but once the sun would come out during the day and I'm walking, you'd get sweaty. But I was so cold and I'm in the plane. And as we take off, suddenly there's a sensation at my heels in the plane. I was like, And then there was this moment, this like 5 second lapse, and then suddenly my mind comes in labeled heat. A heater had come, you know, there was blowing heat onto the flight, and I was like, heat. Like, I hadn't felt that. I mean, they had a little bit of fire sometimes in the dining rooms, but I hadn't really experienced that thing. Something so simple, like appreciating that we have heated places in the winter, that for him it was rain. And then Hinton said, if I'm angry and unforgiving, they will have taken the rest of my life. A huge space of mine. Huge space of mine. And then from a priest, we've heard of Brother Steindl Rast. Some of you have read some of his works. Whatever life gives to you, you can respond with joy. Joy is the happiness that does not depend on what happens. It's the grateful response to the opportunity that life offers you at this moment. And then Hinton goes on to tell you, he said, I can tell you that I'm happy because I choose to be happy. So it's always a choice, kindness, love, joy, happiness. You always have a choice there. Okay? Some of it may involve us analyzing why my mind's responding this way, what I think the motivation of the other person is that is tweaking me right now. Like, we do need some analysis. Some may go on in front of the person, but that's sometimes too challenging because something's unfolding quickly. That's why we do the practice on our cushion. So later, I didn't do it very well in front of the person. I go home, I sit down, and then I go, well, I totally blew that today, so what happened? Let me go back into it. Let me review. Well, he said that thing that was rude. Okay, well, he's always rude, but it's not about me personally. You know, he's really suffering. His kid is sick. He has financial struggles, or maybe we don't know that about the person. But so we never consider it. We never think of what motivates them. And on, you can analyze like that. So one of our practices to practice gratitude is rejoicing. The easiest way to make positive energy, to create merit on this path, rejoicing. When we rejoice, we celebrate our good fortune and the good fortune of others. We celebrate our good deeds, things like that. It's a really easy way to create positive energy and merit. Okay. Another thing, and this is a little more superficially U.S., smile. Okay. My act of practicing rejoicing, I noticed, I would at least put my face in the expression. My mind wasn't there yet, but it was interesting getting the face in that way. And I do notice when I'm in airports and out at the grocery store, and if I'm dressed like this and people see me and I see them, they don't want to stare, but they're like, again, what is that? You know. But if I smile, it disarms them. You know, I smile and then they're kind of like, oh, okay, I think it's safe. I think it's okay over there. Like, she's smiling. Then it's hard for people to kind of hang on. So you can also practice that. I think that it's really been helpful. It triggers positive emotions like that. And then related to this, and okay. The next quality of the heart is compassion. It's compassion. We're pretty familiar with compassion. We've talked about it a lot in general in our courses. It's a big part of Buddhism. Biblical Hebrew word for compassion, rachamim, comes from the root for womb, rechem. Okay? And the Dalai Lama will say it's from our mother's nurturing that we learn compassion. Okay? There's nothing wrong with father's love and nurturing, but there's nothing like that mother love. Nothing like that mother love. It's not that fathers aren't great, but there's something of all my friends that have kids, what I notice is how the mothers are the ones that, you know, they're up late till the kid comes in, the fathers are sleeping generally, right? It's the mothers that wake up first thinking about their kids, first taking care of these. The mothers that are really wound in a way like that. I know when my mother died, quite a while ago, and then a monk friend of mine, his mother died like a month before, and then he came to our center to teach, and then he said to me, and now the person that thought of you first is gone, like that. Because there's that mother love, the mother, and a lot of my friends that are married in straight relationships, male, female, that have kids, the guys will tell me about their wives, well, for her, it's all about the kids. You know, she's really, it's all like, we couldn't do this because it was about the kids. Well, she had to go because that's where the girls were. And some of my female friends will say, in retirement now, some of them are retiring, winding down, downsizing their houses, moving into something smaller. And a lot of the women have said, well, we're basically going to go wherever the kids are. Or wherever she moves, we're going to move there. But the father doesn't say that. The fathers have other ideas sometimes. But the mothers are like, no, we're moving to Seattle. Like that. And I look at the father and I go, are you moving with her? Or is she just going, you know, and then he'll just nod. Like, yeah, whatever she said. Yeah, you know. So it's interesting. So think about that. It's interesting for compassion in biblical Hebrew from the womb. Okay? Compassion is in many ways expanding this maternal instinct that was very pivotal when you were developing we needed that to develop, to get born, basically, like that. And it's just kind of the survival of the species. So I'd like to kind of see a female president in the United States of America and just see if our defense budget would be as large as it is now. It could be, but I think probably not, is what I'm guessing. Okay. So when you're walking in the street, okay, when you pass people, you know, can we have the heart of compassion? Can we kind of bring that maternal womb of energy of the goodness of that side of it with us? You're in the store. Do you ever greet the cashiers, people in the, you know, can I have that compassion about thinking about their well-being a little bit? People you're driving next to, you know. I notice like we're kind of tuned out. I don't want anybody in my lane and I want to, you know. But occasionally you pull up at the light at the same time. And occasionally I'll look, you know, you see the person next to you, but if you smile at them, it's really a pleasant, and then they're kind of like, hey, you know. I mean, hopefully they're not picking their nose. Do you ever see that in cars?
Yeah.
People just going for it. Sometimes I'm like, you're surrounded by windows. Hello? Like, do you think you're alone? And they're just like, you know. But it's kind of neat when you do smile. They, you know, and you're like, hey. You know, and sometimes people, and I notice people will pull up, and I was in a lane. There's a lane in my town where both lanes can go straight, but then it quickly narrows. But what happens is it's better if you do get in the other lane because there's a huge backup of cars at rush hour behind this, and everybody tries to get in the left lane, and then the right lane's empty. But if both cars went up, they say for traffic patterns, it's better. If people are cooperative. So when you cross the street and then people will let you in. So what I did is I pulled up and I was next to a car and I was in the lane and I could feel them jut forward a little bit, like to make sure like I'm going before you. But they weren't looking. But I looked, I turned and tried to engage them. And sometimes they won't look at you because they don't want to have any personal kind of interconnection with you because they want to beat you out. So they can't, you know, you see the whole mentality of. So, but I turned and somehow I got their attention and they looked. And I was just like calmly, hey, you know, and then they relaxed. And then we both, like the light turned green and we both just gently pulled out and I let them go. I'm like, you go. I'll get in after you. I don't have any urgency to have to be first. But it was a little bit more, a little nicer, compassionate driving. Why not? Compassion's contagious. We know that. And compassion, the warm feeling you get from helping others, okay, scientifically, comes from the release of oxytocin. And it's the same hormone that is released by lactating mothers, mothers that are nursing, okay? This hormone has health benefits as well, including the reduction of inflammation in the cardiovascular system. So compassion literally makes your heart healthy and happy. That works. It's also contagious, as we know. So when you see somebody else doing something compassionate, you're more likely to suddenly be, that's that joy of elevation. Oh, wow. Oh, I can help too. I can help too. So there's a ripple effect that can extend out beyond. Experiments with large numbers of people show that if you're kind and compassionate, your friends' friends, and even their friends are more likely to become kind and compassionate like that. Sometimes you notice if you walk into an event, a dinner, a party like that, even you come into the center. Now, the centers tend to be nicer places. People say, I feel safe at the center. That was my first attraction to Buddhism. When I came back to the States and started exploring Buddhist centers, I noticed how good I got at the center when I walked into the center. Everybody was good, so I started mirroring back. I liked it, but when I go out on the street, then I kind of resort back to my old gunky kind of mind. But in the center, because that's people were more, it was the kind of thing in a center, when you put your pen down, nobody would steal it because they had this ethical conduct of not stealing. So you kind of go, there's my pen. Oh, that's right. Nobody took it. Where other places could easily disappear, but not at Buddhist centers necessarily. You know. So we fear compassion because we're afraid of experiencing suffering because it puts us into a place of vulnerability. But we've talked a little bit about vulnerability. Vulnerability sometimes we think of as helplessness. Okay, that. This helplessness can come from having an open heart, okay? But it's actually Brené Brown's thing of vulnerability is the birthplace of innovation, creativity, and change. That's not about helplessness at all. Not about helplessness at all. We feel sometimes if we're really compassionate, we'll be taken advantage of. We say this on the Bodhisattva path, but I'll be a doormat. Bodhisattvas, it's active engagement in cherishing others more than yourself. You're not a doormat. And bodhisattvas set healthy boundaries to do the work they need to do because they're so focused on that work. Okay? So I think true compassion doesn't slip into helplessness. You're actually very empowered and feeling very uplifted like that. And again, feel free to set healthy boundaries. Because you're very committed with a good motivation of what you're doing. Then people don't take advantage like that. And then some people are afraid of receiving compassion for others because they're afraid that people will want things in return. Okay? So again, if you set clear delineation, healthy boundaries, and somebody's really helping you, but it would be nice to give back too, to come from a place of wanting to give back because there's joy in that for you. But you have to experiment. So compassion can flow naturally when we understand and work to remove our fears, our blocks, our resistances to it, meaning all of these things I just mentioned. You feel you'll be a doormat. You'll feel people will take advantage of you. You'll feel you will owe somebody something. You will fear that it's a weakness. It'll show a weakness in me. Once I've analyzed those and realized that's not true compassion, okay, then it can flow naturally. Okay? Compassion is one of the most difficult and courageous of all of our motivations. Okay? But it's also the most healing and the most elevating. So acknowledging first the fears and the blocks and then working through them, analyzing slowly. You can try with small acts of compassion first and see how it works like that. So then there's this expression, self-compassion. I've mentioned before that we don't feel it's okay. Because it then kicks into self-cherishing. That's not self-compassion. Self-compassion sets us up for practice, to do more practice. But I have to take care of myself, honestly. But with the motivation that I really want to help, I want all of you to be happy. Okay? But in order for me to do that, then I need to limit this and this so that I have enough energy, that I'm clear enough that I can meet with these people like that. And so I know limits, and I mention things, like when I get really tired, I'll excuse myself if I'm staying at somebody's house, that I need to finish my practice, I need to do that, and I can do it in a nice way, and say, and people always understand. Yeah. And I'll know there's certain triggers, you know the certain coping mechanisms you might have that make you feel good about yourself. So practice those. practice this. Like for me, one instance is I happen to be a bath person. That might not happen much in North Carolina because you have a warmer climate. But in the winter, perfect place to take a bath. I just find that really relaxing and disengaging and just kind of quiet time. It doesn't have to take long. But that's a recharge for me when I'm suddenly like, and sometimes I'll have these things, I just need to get in the bathtub right now and just end the story. No phone, no whatever, but do whatever you want to do. You want to light a candle, maybe you have some music you like. Sometimes I read in the bath, something like that. So what it is, but it just could be a half an hour, and I just, you know, maybe you put some scented whatever you want to put in that you like, something like that. And, you know, so find out what are those things that, you know, within reason, that, you know, you might say, well, I really feel like, you know, buying the latest sports car is really going to do it for me. Well, you know, that may not be possible, but you like ice cream. Okay? Now, you may not want to eat too much ice cream, but you like ice cream, so you go out and you treat yourself at your favorite ice cream store and have an ice cream cone. Or take a friend out that likes ice cream and you buy them an ice cream. Self-compassion, but sometimes you need to do that. So figure out what's that thing you're going to do. My evening, and I used to do this in, some of us are overscheduled. Is anybody here overscheduled? Right? So what I did in San Francisco when I was working there, it got very busy before I was really into the Dharma. And it just, my week, it was just gone. And every night was filled with two or three things. It was crazy. So what I started to do was schedule a date with myself one night a week. It went in the calendar. Right? So if somebody said, oh, Friday night, you know, I'm like, oh, and I said, oh, no, I can't do it Friday night, I'm busy. And I really held to it. No, I'm busy. Unless it was something like a once-in-a-lifetime thing, it was on that night, I would move it to another day. But otherwise, you know, have a date with yourself where you do something fun that you enjoy, quiet, uplifting, that makes you feel good. Very, very important, self-compassion. And also having the right view about yourself. That's more important. The right, accurate view about yourself. Letting go of the negative stories that you tell yourself. So, this is from, I really like her, the psychologist, Kristen Neff. She's mentioned in Thupten Jinpa's book, A Fearless Heart. I think I taught that in another course before here. She's identified ways to express self-compassion, and she said, when we treat ourselves with compassion, we accept there are parts of our personality we may not be satisfied with, but we don't berate ourselves as we try to address them. Okay, we're not getting down on ourselves as I'm realizing, well, I really need to do a little better there. I know that I do this. That's one of the things I do, so I want to work on that. When we go through a difficult time, we're caring and kind to ourselves, as we would be to a friend or relative. When we feel inadequate in some way, we remind ourselves that all people have these feelings or limitations. When things are hard, we recognize all people go through similar challenges. And finally, when we're feeling down, we try to understand this feeling with curiosity, there's that word again, and acceptance rather than rejection, and self-judgment. So I like that. When I do something, when I mess up, and when I'm feeling down, curiosity jumps up now. Not getting down, I kind of go, okay, why are we going there now? What's that about? Is that just an old imprint? More and more, you know? Okay. You know? Well, it's almost like a little kid. And I'll say, okay, what do you need? What are you not getting right now? What do you need right now? Just a little self-care. Okay, let's just take care of it, something quickly, maybe in this regard. I pay attention, I listen like that, but I don't kind of reject it and just say, oh, you're lousy. You know, you never do anything right. I look at it. So when Ray Hinton, went to death row after a trial that could be called a travesty of justice, he was very angry and heartbroken. Okay? And he says, when no one believes a word you say, he said, you stop saying anything. He said, I didn't say good morning. I didn't say good evening. I didn't speak to anyone. If the guards needed information from me, I wrote it down. I was angry. And then he said, going into his fourth year like that, he heard a man in the cell next to him crying. And he said, the love and compassion I received from my mother spoke through me. And I asked him what was wrong. And he said he just found out that his mother passed away. And I told him, look at it this way. Now you have someone in heaven who's going to argue your case before God. And then I told him a joke, and he laughed. He said, and suddenly my voice and my sense of humor was back. And he said, for 26 long years after that night, I tried to focus on other people's problems, and every day I did. And I'd get to the end of the day and realize I hadn't focused on my own. He was able to bring love and compassion to a loveless place. And in doing so, Anthony Ray Hinton was able to hold on to his joy in one of the most joyless places on earth. Really impressive. You know, when he was in prison, he watched 54 people, 53 men and one woman, go to their deaths. And he got his fellow inmates to start banging on the bars of their case before the execution. And he said, I discovered on death row other inmates had not had the unconditioned love that I had for my mother. We became a family, and we didn't know that if any other family and friends were there, he said, so by banging on the bars, we were going to be the family of the person being put to death, and we were going to say to them, we're with you, and we still love you right to the end. It's very moving, those kind of things. I find it very moving. So this brings me to the last pillar is generosity. The last pillar of joy is generosity. Generosity is often something we learn to enjoy by doing. It's probably for this reason charity is prescribed by every religion, okay? It's one of the five pillars of Islam called zakat. In Judaism, they call it tzedakah, which means justice, okay? Hinduism and Buddhism, it's called dana. Christianity, charity. They all have it. Generosity is so important in all the world's religions because it no doubt expresses a fundamental aspect of our interdependence and our need for one another. If we had more time, what I would do in a few of the pillars we just looked at is what I like to do is with forgiveness is often move through the medium scope of the Lam Rim, that is a medium motivation, a person with a medium motivation, meaning built upon the earlier motivation of the topics we covered yesterday, I actually start to realize that even life the way I have it now is still suffering. And I'd really like to generate a renunciation of that. Okay. And then you move into the greater scope motivation where I realize it's not just enough to free myself from suffering if all these other beings are suffering. But just looking at the middle scope, wanting to release myself from suffering, it's helpful to explore the different ways you suffer. And then to expand that to how all beings suffer that way. We suffer from birth, old age, sickness, and death. We're familiar with that to some degree. We suffer from loneliness. We suffer from meeting with what we don't want to meet with and who we don't want to meet with. And we suffer from separating from what we do like and what we don't want to separate from. We suffer from you're really high one moment, everything's going on great in your life, and the next moment you're broke and ill. Happens to people all the time. There's suffering, which is related to like a suffering of change. We know blatant suffering. Suffering is suffering, they say. You have a headache. You're sick, something like that. But then there's the suffering of change, more subtle. Things are always changing. We resist. Okay? So we're somewhat familiar. There's lots of changes of, there's suffering of dissatisfaction. We know some people with very unsatisfied minds. They're never happy with anything. Right? So much suffering like that. What about the suffering of uncertainty? The unknown, you don't know. You know, you have a health issue, and there's the doctor, and will this go away? When will I get better? Will you be able to fix it? Is there a treatment for this? And sometimes they're like, I don't know. A lot of suffering from that. Suffering of when something starts, what time does it start? What time does it end? Well, it's supposed to end at that time, but it didn't end at that time. You know, you go out to your car, a car doesn't start. Uncertainty. So many things we don't know, we're uncertain about. You think you have your job for all the time, and then you get notice, we're downsizing, we're changing, we were bought by somebody else. Changes. Your relationships change. Now we're all going to change up our practices, right? Excited about that. But so it's interesting to explore all those sufferings to come into and then explore the pillar of forgiveness, which can relate to that too, of the sufferings that get us kind of bogged down in that. And then when you come into gratitude is another help, I think, which counteracts the suffering. If I have more of an experience of gratitude. Compassion comes into the higher scope of bodhicitta practices. Bodhicitta practices. Developing the good heart. And then the interesting part of developing bodhicitta also involves the six perfections. The first perfection is generosity, the eighth pillar of joy. So really developing the good heart. What we say in Buddhism, the reason it leads off and it's the first of the six perfections is it's from which everything flows. It's how to have a flow of dharma in your life. Generosity is not just about giving money, but it's certainly involved in that. And we were talking a little bit in here with some people from the center about it. It's interesting with, you know, some of our centers really struggle financially. And monks and nuns often in the West don't have a lot of support. People think we're supported by FPMT. We're not. We're on our own. So you might be stationed at a center. You might be assigned to a center. And I was at two retreat centers and one city center where I lived. So they provided me a simple place to live in exchange for my work. You know, and sometimes I'd get a small stipend. Sometimes no stipend. Like that. So basically that's the reality. And the way a lot of us survive is based on the kindness of others. Like that. That's the way the centers survive. Is from your benefacting something or sponsoring something or supporting, joining, contributing. It's the only way. I can't say that enough. And with Westerners, we have this charity begins at home idea. You come to a place and the last thing you want to hear, oh, they're asking for money again. Catholic Church does it. With a portion of your salary, they're very upfront about it. So why can't we do it at Buddhist centers? I had people come up to us at Buddhist centers, retreat center, with a week-long retreat they wanted to attend and stay there and eat the food. And they said, well, the Dharma's free in India. Oh, so did you go to a United Airlines and say, I'd really like to fly to India? Oh, do I have to pay? Why? Right? So they had to fly over, buy a ticket. The Dharma's not free in India, by the way. If you stay at a retreat center, you pay for the food and lodging. It's very clear. The Dharma teachings are always free. But to come to a Dharma teaching and think not to give a donation, that's just ignorance. That's just ignorance. It's just because you don't know. You haven't been taught. I would never show up at a Dharma teaching and not make an offering. It's the least I can do. And that creates a flow of Dharma in your life, a flow of money. Generosity is actually the cause of your prosperity. It's completely adverse to the whole Puritan, you know, charity begins at home kind of idea that I was raised with. Like that. So it's very interesting. It really took a while for my thinking to transform around it. Really took a long time. And I know there were times when somebody wanted to make an offering to me, like a money offering. And initially I was so uncomfortable because I was raised, you do not take money from anyone. Like, that's how a lot of us were raised. But in the Asian tradition, it's good. That's the only way monks and nuns are supported. So it's very, like in Singapore, they'd rent me an apartment. They take care of everything for me. I wouldn't have to deal with anything. So it's very interesting how the first people, and I remember one of my monk friends from Australia said to me, he saw somebody offered money. I was meditating. They put it on my leg or something. And he saw I went, and he said, don't give it back. Don't give it back to them. They'll totally offend them. Tibetan person. He said, don't give it. And I was like, what? And he said, you can make an offering with it elsewhere, but don't give it back to them. He said that, you know, so it was totally adverse thinking. I had to be like, huh? And then I kind of got it. And then it was great. It's really fun. And I noticed you have TSOG. T-S-O-G. You have an offering ceremony you do a couple times a month maybe. And people bring offerings. Medicine Buddha Puja, Tara Puja. You bring an offering. In California, it became like a competition. People bring two grocery bags full of stuff, their favorite things, snacks, to share. It's like Halloween. That's what you ought to do at Pujas. You bring it. Don't depend on the center doing it. Then the center has to pay more money to do it. We bring it. We're involved in it. It's an act of generosity. There's many ways to be generous. Then you can give of your time. You can lend an ear. You can give the Dharma. You can teach the Dharma. Fantastic. You go into the prisons and do that. Like, there's many ways we can give. Generosity. Okay. And generosity, it's so important for our survival that reward centers of the brain light up. Okay? As strongly as when you give, as when you receive. Like, we loved receiving things. Oh, nice, you got me red socks. Right? But it's the same as when you give. It's still, ding! Okay, especially if you understand generosity and how it functions, like that. So it really creates a map for your long-term well-being. Everybody wants that. That creates your joy. Creates your joy. So there was a World Happiness Report at one point recently, and these people that did it explained that one of the strongest predictors, one of the strongest predictors of well-being worldwide is the quality of our relationships. Okay? Generous, pro-social behavior seems to strengthen these relationships across cultures. So generosity is even associated with better health and longer life expectancy. It seems so powerful that a couple of researchers, just thinking about it, significantly increases the protective antibody immunoglobulin A in your body, a protein used by the immune system. Just thinking about generosity. You know, I know Lama Zopa Rinpoche once said, even if you have the thought to give or the wish or some grandiose thing like that, and Rinpoche does a lot of offerings like that to create that flow of energy, helping to support the organization and things. It's not just about the money, it's about time, I mentioned. How we're able to contribute and be generous to others also creates this how we might feel needed by them and of value to others, and that gives our life meaning. That creates that nice social generous flow of relationships with people. Okay? So let's just for a little quick sum up of the pillars of joy. When we practice a generosity of spirit, we are in many ways practicing all the other pillars of joy. In generosity, there's a wider perspective in which we see our connection to all others. And so this is a nice way, if we had more time in generosity, we talk about interdependence and emptiness. So everything fits in from the Lam Rim in these pillars of joy as well. So we see our connection to others. There's a humility that recognizes our place in the world and acknowledges that another time we could be the one in need, whether that need is material, emotional, or spiritual. There's a sense of humor and an ability to laugh at ourselves so that we do not take ourselves too seriously. There is an acceptance of life in which we do not force life to be other than what it is. There is forgiveness of others and a release of what might otherwise have been. There's a gratitude for all that we have been given. Finally, we see others with a deep compassion and a desire to help those who are in need. And from this comes a generosity that is wisely selfish, as His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, a generosity that recognizes helping others as helping ourselves. And as the Dalai Lama put it, in fact, taking care of others, helping others, ultimately is the way to discover your own joy and to have a happy life. Any questions or comments? So I know we didn't take a break in the session because I wanted to get through various things. Yes, please.
Briefly, when we were talking about
a little bit more water. Sorry. Thank you.
When we were talking about self-care.
Thank you very much. This room temperature water is great. Thank you.
I learned a lot about that from watching other people. My family did not do that, and I would see other people's family. And so as adults, we are giving an example.
Yes. And I think as Mahayana practitioners, if you're on a Tibetan Buddhist path, eventually you become an example. You're practicing to become that example. That, and that attracts people, whether it attracts them to the path or just realizing they feel safer and more comfortable around you. It's very significant to be that example. Yeah. Andre. And is this helpful for people? It's been helpful. I hope you can review, like go back in and maybe implement a few things. But we also have our, you know, our 16 jewels that are going to be doing their exercises. So I'm excited to like that. Please.
It's more of a comment. The Book of Forgiving, Archbishop Tutu's book, is a book that we use as a textbook in the prison that I teach.
Great.
That book really, really, it was so helpful to these guys, you know, just the whole attitude and understanding the forgiveness. Now, so many of these guys, what people don't realize is that, and aren't aware of, that they know they've done wrong. They deeply, deeply regret what they have done, and they want so much to be forgiven, but they don't believe that they could ever be forgiven. For what they've done,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so in the way that Archbishop Tutu laid it out about forgiveness and the part that you read and so forth,
mm-hmm.
really, really rung home. You know, it really rung a bell for them. Yeah, so
it's a really good book. I really recommend for anybody. It's a really, really great book.
Yeah, Book of Joy is another one we're gonna.
Yeah, that would be another one they'd love.
Yeah.
And I think A Fearless Heart would also be fantastic for them.
Mm.
This is a Book of Joy, again, that I was basing this on. A Fearless Heart, they would love that. I think they'd love it. And it reminds me a little bit, I think I told this story here before. Geshe Gelug was involved. A few years ago, I was in Florida, and we got an email announcement, all the Sangha, and there was a guy on death row in Georgia.
Mm.
And when you go onto death row, there's a 2-week watch where they put you, the execution is in 2 weeks. That was it. His execution was in 2 weeks. And there were still some appeals, but when you get to 2 weeks in this prison, then you get unlimited phone calls in the States. And so they just put it out to our group and said, would anyone like to be on the list that he could call you? So a number of people replied. And somehow I was the second person he called, a guy named Daniel Lucas. And we ended up spending 2 weeks, a few hours a day on the phone. And he was a real practitioner. So he had been in prison about 19 years for murder and had gotten to the Dharma through his artwork and had totally transformed himself.
Mm.
Totally, the sweetest heart. I mean, it was really bizarre to say. Anyway, so we got to be very close in 2 weeks. I really liked the guy. So we were doing a lot of practice, Vajrasattva, reading prayers together, meditations, whatever he wanted to do. And he had done a lot of the DB modules. And then he wanted to renew refuge vows, so I did that. But then he wanted bodhisattva vows. And I haven't asked Rinpoche if I could do. I keep meaning to kind of ask. But I thought Geshe Gelug would be good to involve him in the same time zone. So then I called Geshe, and Geshe spoke to him and spent some time on the phone with him and gave him bodhisattva vows. And he was really happy. And so, you know, you get so involved with, you know, and then there's appeals, and then they had a big clemency hearing. So here's somebody who, people on death row, for the most part, if you look at the statistics, their families become fragmented. And if they're together, often there's divorces, and then this one's not speaking to this one, and there's blame and anger. And a lot of the people are poor, and the families don't have resources, and they're just, the frustration's overwhelming and the pain. But his parents had been divorced in this time, in the 19 years, and they reconciled because of him, and they all came together, his sister, they all presented at the clemency hearing, and different people presented this, and his artwork, and his training, and his Buddhist stuff, and we were all kind of involved. And then through that, I got involved with, like, one person on his legal team that happened to be in Vermont, and I had been in Vermont, and she and I had a connection. And then another woman from the Shambhala Center near him, a Buddhist center, who had been going to do meditations with him, like you're doing visits, she was allowed to go, and it ends up that she grew up in the town next to me, where my brother lives. So she and I had this connection, and she called me on the phone once, and we were reminiscing. She's like, is that place still there for the, you know, and we're still hoping to meet one day. And then, so all these people kind of formed this community that came together in this incredibly harmonious kind of thing. And so the clemency thing, the lawyer said it could not have gone any better, and everything was denied. All the appeals were denied, and it wasn't, you know. So then we were coming up to the date of the execution. It's very surreal. But then he said to me, you know, we have to say goodbye because tomorrow they move me to the room next to the execution chamber, and I'm not allowed any phone calls, they told me. So in this case, goodbye is goodbye. Like, I just couldn't believe it. You know, I was like, like, how do you say goodbye like that? But I told him what to think about. Lama Zopa Rinpoche was aware. All these people were praying for him. And so we kind of had this final call. It was really awful. It's really awful. And then, I mean, awful for me, but I'm not the one being executed. Like, I can't imagine for him. So the next day, it was the next day, and then I think it was the execution day, and I had made my father dinner and brought the phone with me. Did I tell this story before? I think, okay. Anyway, I brought the phone into the room, and I don't usually have the phone there. Turned it up, and around 7 o'clock at night, the phone rang. It was him. It was Daniel. And I'm like, what's happened? I said, something good has happened. And he said, no, I'm waiting for the last appeal. I'm in the room next to the execution chamber. They let me call you. Like, this is his last 2 hours. And he calls me. And suddenly I'm just like, you know, I need to not blow it right now. This is like the last conversation he's going to have with somebody. I just thought, like, oh my God, like, I was honored that he called me, first of all. I told him that. I said, I can't believe. So we did these, and his lawyer would cut in at times and say, we haven't heard anything yet. I think the governor was involved. I don't know, this whole thing. And then, so we're on the phone for a couple of hours, and then we're doing different practices and prayers, and the poor guy had to keep interrupting because obviously his nerve level was extreme, so he had to keep running to the bathroom and coming back. And I said, don't worry about it. And then at 9 o'clock, the lawyer came in and said, I'm sorry, it's been denied. So then the lawyer cut off, and he said, I think they're going to be moving quickly now, because they don't want to then have it linger, because you know that they're going to execute you. And he was gone 45 minutes later. I couldn't believe, like, I hadn't never been that close to anything like that. You know, I've talked to prisoners, I've written to prisoners, but I've never been, because I don't think a lot of Buddhists end up on death row, but there are some. There's definitely some, and some of them have been executed. That was in Georgia a few years ago. So I have a thing. I think I have his picture on my blog on the website. So yeah, it's horrible, capital punishment. I'm really opposed to it like that. I mean, we were talking about, they call it a Department of Corrections. What if you get corrected?
Yeah.
Like, can you get corrected? I believe you can. That's what we're doing. Right? And then what happens if you get corrected? Like, what happens if you really messed up? But can you get corrected? And if you get corrected, will they give you a reprieve and let you at least live your days out in prison? And he had apparently had such a positive influence on many other prisoners, is what I heard. So, yeah, so it's, and then the interesting thing was, There's guards that watch you when you're in the room next to the execution chamber. And in the last 2 weeks, there's guards 24 hours a day to make sure, you ready for this? That you don't commit suicide so they can kill you later. Okay. So it's bizarre. But this is what happened with the guards. He said some of the guards didn't really have much to say to him and interact. And they must do to protect themselves. Because how many people have they lost? That they, you know, it's really heavy. Okay, so some of them, he said, really wouldn't interact with him. But some of them really interacted with him. And he said, and some of them started asking him about this. And he said, well, it's my faith that kept me. And they said, well, what's your faith? And he starts teaching them Dharma. And I said, Daniel, you have no idea the effect that the seeds you're planting for these prison guards. Like, how many different prison guards funneled through the weeks, and he's teaching them Dharma. It was amazing. Incredible, though.
That's my hope. That's what we're trying to do, so mm-hmm. they can pass this on.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Another book, if I can just, a great book, and we're teaching from this book now, it's called Razor Wire Dharma. It's by Calvin Malone. This guy became Buddhist in prison, and then he began to create a Buddhist group in this prison.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible. I just Googled him. He's 69 years old. He did about a 27-year stint. He's 69. He just passed away last year.
Mm.
But what he's done, he would have no idea. I wanted to write him. That's why I Googled him. I want to write him, let him know that we're using his book as a text. But he's gone now. Yeah.
And there's a few texts like that of people in prison that became Buddhist and transformed. And I'm sure there's some of Christianity and other religions where people found their way through the faith and totally transformed their anger and hostility. And these groups that, like, people teaching Buddhism in prison is really been pretty amazing for people. I have a number of friends that do that as well. Anything else? Yes.
So I just wanted to make a comment about how your sense of compassion comes from your mother's love. And my mother has narcissistic personality disorder. So some of us have to use our imagination.
Yeah, but there could be, what I meant is the mother love. It doesn't mean your particular mother, because some people had abusive mothers.
Yeah.
But that there's a maternal thing, and it might be somebody else in your life that...
It's hard.
Hopefully, if there was somebody else that had that, could be a grandmother, an aunt, an uncle, a grandfather, a father, that some people don't have that. That's true. Some people don't have that. So that's very difficult.
Yeah. I also wanted to say that I read Catherine Neff's book on self-compassion.
Yes.
And it's life-changing.
Yeah. She's fantastic.
And she really taught me how to be my own mother.
Kristen Neff, yeah.
Yeah.
Kristen Neff.
How to be my own mother. And when you're not provided for, you can provide for yourself.
That's right. So. That's right. And on some level later, if you get into Buddhism, I don't know how into Buddhism you are, it's amazing what the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha provides for you. Nobody ever starved on the Buddha's watch, for one, but it's amazing, the sustenance in a deeper level, sustenance of all those things you have holes in that you're missing, that you never got, it's all there. If you have the right guru, even more so, even more so, like really. So sometimes we didn't get that lot, this life with a mother or a father or family and things like that. I know people that went through the system without any family, you know, foster people and It's at least there's some other avenues.
Yeah.
Fortunately.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. So do we have any idea about more joy in our lives from this? Can we reflect on the eight pillars? And you might want to just reflect on those, stick them on your refrigerator, so that you can, you know, you have an off day and you come in and you go, oh, compassion, acceptance. Oh, yeah, acceptance, that's right. I forgot about that. I'm not doing that right now. I'm not accepting myself. I'm not accepting others. We can play with them a little bit. Roll them into, you can put them in your office or your workplace like that. Well, in conclusion, because we are out of time, I'd like to dedicate that whatever merit, I'd like to turn to the Gold Prayer Book. We're going to read this prayer from Master Shantideva. I'd like to dedicate whatever positive energy, again, we've created. May it only be folded into our practices to fully wake us up so we can become Buddhas. Then we're unlimited in helping all other beings and really leading them to joyous places like that. Page 246. And let's really send this out to the universe. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. Medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Page 244, the Long Life Prayers. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serves the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjunath's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplished magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. For the long lives, perfect health of all of our precious teachers, like Geshe Gelug, and may our practices be flourishing and healthy, for the fires in Australia to be extinguished immediately, for the coronavirus to stop to be spread, and all the suffering on the planet, may it be eliminated instantly. Any other dedications, please call out if there's somebody you'd like to dedicate to. I'd like to add Jack Sonnenbaum, who passed away recently in California.
Jim Davis.
And may we have a successful, healthy, happy, harmonious pilgrimage to Laodo this May. And thank you so much. Thank you very, very much for coming. Thank you for your attention and your participation. And I hope to see all of you again. If you need a card, I am leading some retreats in California the end of February. There might be something in New York at Garrison Institute this year, hosted by our New York Center. There's something in, if you feel to go over to Asia, I'm leading something over there in June, like a Lojong mind training retreat, like that. So please enjoy if there's something else, and thank you so much, and please be happy. Choose kindness, choose love. Thank you very much.
And we're now going to offer a mandala to Venerable Amy to thank her for these wonderful teachings. So please join in page 100 in the Gold Prayer Book. And we'll recite the short mandala offering and the request for the Lama to remain long. And then afterwards, there's an opportunity, if anybody would like to make a personal offering to Venerable Amy, you can do so. Saji Puki Chuxing Me Tog Chamri Rabling Shi Ni De Gyan Padi Sangye Jing Du Mikte Kuna. Shog Jetsun Lame Kute Rapten Ching Nam Katrin Le Chok Chur Gepadang Lo Zang Ten Pei Tren Me Sasum Hidro We Mun Sel Talk To Nekyur Chik Iram Guru Ratna Mandala Kam Niryatayami.